Thanks, Inyo, and thank you everybody for inviting me to give you this update. This pleasure is very mine. And I'm sorry I cannot be there in person. I'm yet to visit Perimeter, and I would be very much like to do that. But just this week, this came out kind of on a week timescale, and this week is just impossible for me to do that. I hope to do this in the near future. So what I'm going to talk to you about is the common theme of the talk is challenges to Lambda CDM and examining those challenges. And I will talk about challenges that arise from dwarf galaxies very nearby, within a megaparsec of the Milky Way, mostly a few megaparsecs, and challenges that were discussed over the past year that come from galaxies at the redshift above 10, so in the first half a billion years of evolution of the universe. Now, the common theme between those two different types of systems that supposedly present challenges to Lambda CDM is that they present challenges, but actually they involve objects of similar masses. They both involve objects that would be classified as dwarf galaxies, except in one case, it's a dwarf galaxy that we see near us. In the other case, it's dwarf galaxies that we see at redshifts larger than 5 or 10. But in both cases, they involve objects of similar stellar mass and very different stages of their evolution, but similar stellar masses. And so therefore, within the galaxy formation framework, we should be able to model them with the same galaxy formation physics, right? So to explain the properties of both galaxies. So that's the common theme of the talk. Now to orient ourselves, because not everybody may be thinking or looking at galaxies every day, let me show you what people usually think about and when word galaxy is used. This is a collection of postage stamp images of galaxies from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Each row is just a random selection of galaxies, and they are arranged from left to right in increasing luminosity or stellar mass. And what you can see is that the galaxies exhibit some regularities. They come with different sizes and luminosities. And as galaxies get brighter, they get larger. Each postage stamp is about 30 kiloparsecs across, so they fixed physical size. And so you can see that bright galaxy is going to fill the entire square, whereas smaller galaxies, they're smaller in size, physical size. We also see that galaxies change in appearance and color. In the middle, where Milky Way lives, the galaxies tend to be spiral. In the disk configuration, in the most massive galaxies, most systems are spheroidal, and at lowest masses, they're bluish and often irregular dwarf galaxies. So this is what usually has been studied by astronomers as galaxies up until about two decades ago. In the last two decades, we have extended this realm of galaxies very much to the left of this diagram to masses less than a billion. So the smallest masses here are about billion solar masses. But now we study galaxies with masses as low as 100 solar masses, which have stellar masses smaller than many star clusters in the Milky Way. And that extension, the reason it happened relatively recently, is kind of illustrated by this slide, which shows you an image of a fairly massive, what's considered to be a relatively massive dwarf galaxy with mass of 10 million solar masses. And this is an image at its location in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And I don't know, on my screen, I can kind of see where the galaxy is. I don't know the quality of displays that you guys are seeing, but there's a faint galaxy here in the middle. And if we switch in the same field from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey to dark energy survey image, which is taken with a larger telescope at a better site, so much larger sensitivity, hopefully you see that there's a very clear faint fudge here, which corresponds to this galaxy at about 10 megaparsec distance. But it kind of illustrates to you that these systems are faint, and so they're difficult to detect, even though they're nearby, just a few megaparsecs away. And galaxies of even smaller mass, in this case, 10,000 solar masses, are even harder to see. This is dark energy survey image. There is a Leo 4 galaxy, 145 kiloparsecs from the Milky Way. And you essentially see, like, if you look at it with untrained eye, you see nothing here. It looks like just a field filled with galaxies and stars. But there is a concentration of faint stars here with clever techniques that people have learned to use. A system can be detected, a dwarf galaxy of about 10,000 solar masses. And as I said, 10,000 solar masses is now are smaller than many star clusters in the Milky Way, but these are galaxies, and we know that they are galaxies because they have high velocity dispersions. Velocity dispersions inconsistent with just stellar mass, right? So we know that these systems are embedded in dark matter halos because they have velocity dispersions that indicate presence of much significantly more mass than we see in stars. Now, so this is why it's difficult, but people have learned with better surveys and better detection techniques, people learn how to detect these galaxies. And this is a nice illustration of a revolution that happened in the last two decades. So this is a number of galaxies within 300 kiloparsecs of the Milky Way as a function of time. With classical photographic plates, people have found about a dozen galaxies, those are called classical satellites because they were known for a while, for decades. And then you can see that from about 2003, there is a sudden jump in red. This is jump due to a slow longitudinal sky survey. They surveyed large portion of the sky with uniform CCD photometry and allowed to systematic searches for galaxies. And those found about 30 galaxies or so. And then a second jump due to dark energy survey and pan-star surveys, which doubled the number of dwarf galaxies again. And so instead of the situation that we had around 2000, where people saw that there is not enough satellite galaxies around Milky Way to compare to what is predicted by models and models, to sort of provide a baseline, the models like cold dark matter, in particular cold dark matter with lambda, with vacuum energy. We think we know how structures form in the case of dark matter in this type of model. They form from initial perturbations and they exist with a spectrum that is predicted pretty well from early models of the universe. And when we evolve these initial perturbations through time, we expect that a galaxy like a halo, like a Milky Way, is filled with small-scale structure. And you can see that there's dozens of these small-scale structures within 300 kiloparsec radius shown by this circle here. And so initially people thought that there was not enough dwarf galaxies, but by now number of dwarf galaxies increased a lot. And now actually dwarf galaxies, not just, we're not talking about missing satellites. We actually can use a number of observed satellites to constrain dark matter models. So the key is that these substructures that survive to redshift zero, they arise from small scale perturbations. And if you consider a model where such small scale perturbations are suppressed, such as warm dark matter model, you will end up with a halo that has many fewer or even completely lacking of any substructure. This has been known for a long time. This is an illustration from paper from Ben Moore from 1999, which shows the lambda CDM halo with substructure and then the corresponding halo forming in warm dark matter, where warm dark matter particle was taken to be quite light. So the velocities at early times are significant. Those velocities of particles erase small scale structure. And so the small-scale structure would not dare to collapse and survive as it does in CDM, and you end up with a halo that is similar for the Milky Way mass, but with no satellites, right? But in models like this, you can crank up the mass, so you can play with the particle mass as a parameter, and you can increase the mass to the levels so that it produces some substructure, it doesn't oversuppress it, and you can produce enough subhalos to host observed galaxies with observed numbers, right? So in this case, this plot shows cold dark matter and warm dark matter, but parameters here are chosen so that the number of satellites that host observable galaxies shown by orange and red is comparable to lambda CDM and comparable to observations. So we can use the observed numbers of galaxies due to these breakthroughs in how many of them were found in the last two decades to essentially, instead of challenging lambda CDM, we actually can challenge other models that were initially developed to fix the supposed paucity of the satellites. So this is an example where the abundance of satellites, the number of Milky Way dwarf galaxies around Milky Way, is used to constrain properties of warm dark matter, self-interacting dark matter, and so-called fuzzy dark matter. This is from paper by Ethan Nadler and collaborators. And what you can see here is a so-called luminosity function of galaxies. So I've used this term quite a bit. And all that means is number of galaxies as a function of their luminosity measured in some band. So this is galaxy luminosity. It's the number of galaxies as a function of that luminosity. These points are measured satellite luminosity function for the Milky Way. And the lines with shaded bands are theoretical model functions in different models. The dotted line is Lambda CDM and other lines are these models with parameters adjusted so that they can reproduce this abundance, right? So models now are not free to have parameters, they any parameters you want. The parameters should be such that this number of observed satellites is reproduced, and these are these parameters for each of the models, right? So effectively, this adjustment makes these models look like Lambda CDM, more or less, because you can see that the difference between the lines and dotted lines is not very big. But then if you look at, say, the power spectrum and the fraction of halos that form, you still see that these models are different than CDM, but this difference is shifted towards smaller masses and smaller scales that are not probed by the satellites, by the faintest satellites. So effectively, they're pushed to the scales, which are currently are not accessible to observations. Nevertheless, we can actually do a bit better. So this is how you can constrain properties of the Dekmerovi satellites. But sometimes you can also use a specific feature of a given model to constrain properties of Dekmerovi. So for example, for fuzzy Dekmerovi, Neil and I last year did a study where we showed that the characteristic unique feature of this model, which is the existence of interference patterns in the distribution of density. And this interference pattern is very generic feature of these models because the fuzzy Dekmerovi models assume that the particles are so light that their de Broglie wavelength is on a galactic scale, so from hundreds parsecs to kiloparsec scales, and therefore these particles exhibit wave properties on galactic scales. And so when people did simulations of halos forming in such models, they showed that this general expectation is correct, and the halos that you can see here are filled with small perturbations of this amplitude of order unity that are all over the place, and they're moving around because particles are moving around and this interference pattern is moving around. Now, because the density fluctuates, it means that if you have any tracers moving inside this potential, these tracers would be affected. And what we did is we showed that with fluctuations that are expected for fuzzy Dekmerovi halos, if you assume a particular mass, this assumes a relatively light mass, so larger perturbations. This is assumes a larger mass of about 2 times minus 19. This is 2 times 10 minus 19. This is 8 times 10 minus 19. And so depending on assumed mass, the perturbations are smaller or larger, but they always have about order of unity amplitude. And so you can then embed stellar particles inside such potential and see what effect these fluctuations can have. And the general effect is expected that the stellar particles will be heated because they're moving through fluctuating potential. So the net effect is that fluctuation potential imparts energy and particles will both expand in space. So they will increase the size of their distribution and increase velocity dispersion. So this is what is shown here in the simulation, where simulation is starts either with very small radius, like 1 parsec, because we don't know the exact starting radius, or if stellar particles are started at the radius of observed galaxy. In this case, it's one of the dwarf satellites of the Milky Way, one of the smallest ones with half-life radius of only 40 parsecs. So regardless of where we assume it starts in a few billion years, if we embed this object in a fuzzy Dekmerovi halo, assuming particle of 10 to minus 19, the size increases beyond the observed limit and velocity dispersion also increases beyond the observed limit. And if we vary the particle mass to find the values that are consistent with the size and velocity dispersion observed for this galaxy, we can put a limit, and this can be done statistically by deriving posterior distribution. We can put a 95% limit, upper limit of 3 times 10 to the minus 19 on this mass. And this pretty much excludes the fuzzy, so-called fuzzy Dekmerovi regime. So the particles could be light, but they can be lighter than this value. This is an illustration for how specific properties of a given model can also, and properties of observed dwarf galaxies can be used to constrain Dekmerovi. But this is fuzzy Dekmerovi. We're talking about challenges of Lambda CDM. And the second challenge, in addition to challenges from dwarf galaxies that I'll discuss in detail, is now coming also from the highest stretches, where similar type of galaxies, again, with masses less than billion solar masses, were detected by first Hubble Space Telescope, but these detections were uncertain because Hubble Space Telescope had no ability to confirm the distances, confirm the redshifts. But nevertheless, small objects were found at in the deep Hubble Space Telescope images, like this one. This is Hubble Ultra Deep Field, with this zooming in a little bit on it, and you can see all kind of galaxies here. With the brightest galaxies here are some low redshift nearby galaxies, but the faintest smudges that you see, some of them are at redshifts above 5. And of course, with Hubble, we cannot see their morphology very well. We cannot confirm their distances reliably. So these studies were ongoing with Hubble Space Telescope, but they were difficult because they could not be really confirmed. The distances and stellar masses could not be really confirmed for these galaxies. Nevertheless, with last year, after successful launch of JWST, JWST performs pretty much as expected. In fact, better than expected. It has better resolution, better sensitivity in most of its detectors. And it has ability to not only observe stars at longer wavelengths, which allows us to push to higher redshifts, because galaxies that emit an optical in ultraviolet at redshifts beyond 10, all that emission is shifted to the infrared. So detectors and the telescope have to be sensitive to infrared light, and JWST was designed with this in mind, with lots of infrared detectors and spectrographs. And it's a larger telescope. It's a 6-meter telescope. It flies in space, so it has very high spatial resolution and therefore very high sensitivity. And so it can, what appeared in HST images as smudges, it can resolve, it can actually detect morphology of these galaxies. And importantly, it can detect these galaxies to higher redshifts, and also in many cases can also confirm the spectra by taking spectra of these faintest objects. So this is an illustration from a study, one of the JWST projects called SEERS, which shows the capability of JWST in a surveyed field that they did with JWST. They detected a bunch of galaxies from redshift 3 to 9, for which they can actually see the morphologies. They can see the light distribution. Many of these galaxies have disturbed morphologies, which is expected because they form at this is early stages of galaxy formation. And during early stages from galaxy formation models, it is expected that merger rates are higher, galaxies are created at a higher rate, and therefore they should be largely more disturbed than nearby galaxies. Nevertheless, another result was also, this is from another major survey called JADES. They also showed that many of the galaxies at redshift 5, 6, 4 have pretty regular morphologies, not particularly disturbed. Whether they're disks or whether they're spheroid, it's another matter. It's been debated right now, but one of the surprises from JWST was that many galaxies at these high redshifts have pretty regular morphology. So they are sort of fairly well evolved. And the largest surprise is actually that there are many of these galaxies. When people tried to look for galaxies beyond redshift 10, they found a bunch immediately. And the first impression was that the number of galaxies that were found beyond redshift 10 is far beyond what's expected. And so that's how this local dwarf galaxies and the high redshift galaxies, how they can be tied together, because they both involve galaxies in what we call dwarf regime. So they have galaxies with stellar masses in most cases, not in all cases. There are some massive galaxies detected at high redshifts as well, but majority of galaxies for which people measure luminosity function, they actually have masses less than billion solar masses. So they're similar to dwarf galaxies nearby, but now JWST detects them at high redshifts, the redshift beyond 5. So that's one similarity. And the second one is that they both generate controversies. The dwarf galaxies continuously generate headlines like this. And some of them are justified, some are not justified, but this is where challenges come from and controversy. And sometimes it's claimed that Dark Matter is in crisis, and some people even claim that the properties of dwarf galaxies indicate that Dark Matter doesn't exist. And at high redshifts over the past year, the headlines were like this, where, you know, ranging from reasonable, where luminosity DM is challenged, to completely unreasonable that Big Bang is wrong, and so on. And so this is where it's interesting to examine these challenges on dwarf galaxy scale. And at high redshifts, like I said, they involve galaxies of similar stellar mass, and they should be able to examine those problems using the galaxy formation framework involving the same type of processes. So that's what I'm going to do in the remainder of the talk. But before I do that, maybe I can stop and see if there are any questions about what I said.
I have a question.
Yeah.
There's a lenticular galaxy, NGC 1277.
I can't hear very well.
There's a lenticular galaxy, NGC 1277, which is compact and massive, about 10 to the 11 solar masses.
And 10 to 11.
Papers demonstrated that it has little or no dark matter. How do you account for this?
And just try to increase the sound volume. But I think I understood the question. So I think the question, the way I heard it, is that there are specific galaxies, and this one was lenticular galaxies that show no sign of dark matter, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I don't know about this specific galaxy. I'll have to look at what's available for it. But in general, massive galaxies with masses beyond Milky Way, they often have very concentrated distribution of baryons, where baryons are completely dominating the inner regions of the galaxies where we measure the light. And so there could be apparent lack of need for dark matter because baryons dominate. And within the uncertainties with which we measure the mass profile, dark matter of zero may be consistent with that galaxy. So that's my impression. So in many such galaxies, baryons dominate, and therefore it's difficult to actually measure what dark matter is. But for the Milky Way, we see that dark matter is there, say, at the solar radius. I think Mike has a question.
I was just going to try to answer it, that I think that that galaxy 1277 is right next to 1275, which is the dominant BCG in the Perseus cluster. And it's also the one that has quite a high black hole mass for its stellar mass. So one plausible answer to all these questions is that it is highly stripped. It is strips most of its dark matter away, and then it has also stripped some of its stars, leaving the black hole supermassive for the amount of stars it has left. That could be one interpretation.
Yeah,
it's right down in the center of the cluster, right near the big BCG.
The other interpretation is that gravity has to be modified.
It wouldn't be my first choice, but
yeah. So there are also a class of galaxies called ultra diffuse galaxies, for which people find, for at least for some of them, that there is very little dark matter, and that's been debated of what's going on with these galaxies. But I think it's fair to say that a majority of galaxies for which we measured mass profiles and the dark matter is required. As a dark matter modification of gravity, but I'm assuming that we're working with a model that has dark matter as an explanation for those.
Thank you.
So, any more questions? Any other questions?
Another question. How do you account for the formation of supermassive black holes and galaxies within 500-700 million years through
that's a very interesting question. That's a very interesting question. This is one of the breakthroughs that is occurring with JWST, that people are measuring black holes and black hole stellar mass relation, black hole mass stellar mass relation at redshift beyond five, and the black holes do seem to be ubiquitous. Their formation requires processes, very efficient accretion on the black holes, and I think this accretion is not understood. There are several ideas for how you can form them. You can form them by accretion onto seeds stemming either from population three stars that are expected to be massive and should leave black holes of masses from tens to hundreds of solar masses behind them. And those could be seeds for black holes growing, or you can have so-called direct collapse where some significant concentration of baryons creates a star that's just too massive and collapses. There are also ideas for how you can form massive seed black holes from star clusters that can form after population three. But then regardless of this initial seed, what seems to be required to form black holes with observed masses is very efficient accretion. And how this accretion occurs, I think, is not fully understood, because the problem of formation of black holes, I think, is much more difficult than problem of galaxy formation of a stellar system around them, because it requires resolving processes on much smaller scales and also with much more complicated physics. So it's an open problem.
Yeah, because it's very difficult to extend the lifetime of of the universe, because you can run into problems with data. Also, it doesn't help it because the ionization time is between 400 million years and about 900 million years when galaxy formation takes place. And that doesn't change when you increase the lifetime of the universe. It's an interesting problem. Thank you.
Yeah. But I should say that in the what I'm going to be talking about, the galaxies of masses less than billion solar mass, the black holes are not, it's a separate problem, and they're not expected to affect the evolution of galaxies of the masses that I was going to consider. Yeah, I think Lee Smalling, do you have a question?
Yes, for these galaxies in the extreme low, and is it possible they could be being confused with black holes that evolve quantum mechanically to white holes and then look like some kind of remnant?
Is there a question? Like, I didn't hear a question.
Oh, sorry. Okay, so let it be a proposal.
I don't know. The only thing I can say is that I do not consider black holes in the model that I'm going to be talking about. And the reason is that the black holes in these small galaxies are either not observed or observed to be too small to really affect the stellar systems of the galaxies.
Okay.
And these systems are also spatially resolved, as you were saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're not black holes. Okay, anyway, yeah.
Yeah, so what you see on this slide is a list of problems that are perceived to be ostensible problems, which Lambda CDM ostensibly has. And they involve dwarf galaxies. There is a planar satellite problem, too big to fail problem, or generally problem with central densities of galaxies. And now also abundance of UV bright galaxies redshift 10. All of these were presented as significant challenges to Lambda CDM. And these are the reasons why those headlines that you see once in a while appear that CDM is in crisis. There is also a problem of density distribution in the central regions of dwarf galaxies. It's I'm not going to touch, but if you want, I can say a few words after the talk, simply because this is not something I examined myself, but other people did. And I think the conclusions from that problem also agree with the conclusion that I'm going to present for these. So I'm going to talk more about what each problem is from when I'm going to talk to it. But first, I want to explain what is the framework, what am I using to examine this problem, because we must have a theoretical framework for examining interpretation of observations and examining whether something is a challenge or not. So I'm going to use a model that is based on halo evolution extracted from n-body simulations largely. And so the backbone of the model is evolution of halo mass in Lambda CDM model. This can be done with direct n-body simulations of how dark matter evolves in Lambda CDM universe. And we for each object that evolves, we can extract how its mass evolves, and it provides a backbone for modeling evolution of the galaxy. In general, galaxy evolution is a complicated process. We use simulations to figure out details of that process, and we know, if anyone has seen animation that comes from simulation, it looks like a background here. I am not trying. I could have shown such an animation, but I know that through Zoom, they often don't work very well. So I sort of decided just to show the temperature distribution that you see in the background here from a simulation where you see a distribution of gas temperature at redshift 4 in the galaxy. And it illustrates that it's fairly complicated. There is a cold gas coming in through filaments. There is a hot gas that gets shocked because these flows are supersonic. Then there is some hot gas that is generated by feedback-driven winds. Inside the galaxy, dynamics of gas in so-called interstellar medium from which stars are forming is also complicated. It's very turbulent, and you can kind of see that it's very non-uniform here. So there's quite a few processes that are involved in galaxy formation. These processes in general seem to be complicated, especially if you look at simulation outputs like this one. But it turns out that the parallel efforts to model galaxies that come from so-called semi-analytic or regulator models that use just differential equations to capture these processes, they show that you can actually get very reasonable results, reproducing results of simulations using such simplified modeling. And so what I'm going to use is precisely such model. It's a regulated type model. We call it Grumpy because it stands for galaxy formation in regulator model in Python. And it's a very forced acronym, but we just wanted to call it Grumpy because we like the name. This is an homage to Grumpy Cat, who passed away in 2020, I believe. And we were working on this model in 2021 during pandemic, and we kind of felt like this. This model involves just a few equations, and all of the equations, all the main equations in the model actually are in this slide. And this is the purpose of the slide is mainly to illustrate that I can actually fit all of the equations to a single slide. It's not that the model overly simplified, but it's simple enough to actually present all of the equations. And the key, you don't need to understand these equations necessarily, all of them, but the key is that there's a few differential equations that use the evolution of the halo mass that's extracted from in-body simulation, then a model for how this translates into evolution of accretion of baryons onto the galaxy. Then there is a model for what happens to those baryons after they accrete, and mainly what happens is star formation. So the mass is reduced by the amount of stars that forms per unit time, the mass that is driven out in outflows that are modeled quite simply, but using a model that is calibrated both from simulations, it's consistent with what we measure in simulations, but also is something that's expected from a simple consideration for so-called energy-driven winds. Then there's a model for how gas is distributed in the galaxy, which is used to compute the amount of molecular gas that is sought to be a source for star formation. So star formation rate is modeled to be proportional to the mass of molecular gas divided by a characteristic time scale over which gas is converted into stars, called depletion time. And also the model follows evolution of heavy elements that is useful if you want to present or compute observable properties of galaxies, just luminosity, because they do depend on metallicity. So this system of differential equations has been solved for a given evolutionary track of halo mass, and it predicts stellar mass, gas mass, heavy element abundance, which we can use to figure out observed properties of galaxies. The model also tracks the size of the galaxy using a model that I'm not going into, but it's calibrated to reproduce observed sizes of galaxies. So why do we use a simple model rather than simulations? Because simulations in the regime where we want to use it, in the regime of the smallest galaxies, and also regime of galaxies at redshift beyond 10, are possible, but extremely difficult. They're both very expensive and also are very difficult to make them reliable due to extreme requirements on resolution. And just to illustrate that this model gives results for bulk properties of galaxies such as stellar mass and halo mass, consistent with simulations that you can see here, so-called stellar mass, halo mass relation. And the model results are shown by this median line with shaded regions and different state-of-the-art simulations from of galaxy formation, where all these processes simulated directly are shown by points, and there's one line here as well. And you can see that they all produce similar type of relation, right? So you can capture what simulations produce with a relatively simple model like this. This is in a dwarf galaxy regime, but even for the Milky Way mass, so if you go to halo masses beyond this limit to 10 to 12 or so, we can see also that this model, which is shown here for the evolution of stellar mass of a galaxy, now for Milky Way type galaxy, where this Grumpy model is shown by the gray lines, and it's compared to the actual Milky Way, where it's measured observationally shown by dashed line, and for different simulations shown by colored lines, you can see that the model also produces evolution quite similar. So we can model these bulk properties with this relatively simple model. Of course, this is comparison with simulations, but the main point for this model is interpretation of observations. And the slide shows a bunch of comparison that we've done in these different papers, which showed that we can reproduce almost like pretty much every property of observed dwarf galaxy population, the metallicity luminosity relation, the diversity of star formation histories, the baryonic Tully Fisher relation, size luminosity, this is luminosity function of Milky Way satellites, and star formation rate stellar mass relations, so-called main sequence of galaxies. And I should say that in some of these correlations are reproduced by calibrating the model, so by changing parameters until we reproduce it. So for example, metallicity luminosity relation was used to calibrate parameters of the model. After this, they're fixed. But baryonic Tully Fisher relation is not, the model is not adjusted to reproduce it. So that relation is reproduced naturally by the model with the same parameters, right? And the same is true for luminosity function of satellites for this relation as well. And something that will become important later in the talk, you can notice that in the star formation rate, stellar mass, so this star formation rate, stellar mass for dwarf galaxies, the model galaxies are red here, whereas observed galaxies are magenta and blue. You can see that on average, the model reproduces the relation pretty well, but the scatter is larger in observed galaxies. And this is, our interpretation is that this is a manifestation of one deficiency. The model is treats star formation on average, as average for both as a function of time and for galaxies as a whole. Whereas star formation in dwarf galaxies is often dominated by a few star forming regions, and which induce stochasticity, so variation of star formation rate on short time scales. And we interpret this observed scatter, that it's larger than in the model, as manifestation of burstiness of star formation, general burstiness of star formation stuff in dwarf galaxies. So on average, they have star formation rate somewhere around here, but over short time scale, the star formation have burst. And I'll come back to this. But before I do that, let me show you what this model.
Wait, sorry, Andre. There was a question, I think, from the audience. Sinaya, did you have a question?
Yes. Hi, Andre. Okay. I think there was something that wasn't quite clear to me. Are you putting this model on top of an N-body simulation?
Yeah.
Okay. So the N-body simulation doesn't have any baryons in it, and you just paint the stars using this model. Okay.
Yes, exactly. It doesn't have any baryons, but when we think baryon effects are important, for example, for abundance of satellites, the baryons can lead to additional disruption due to the presence of the disk. That process is included in the model. So when we think N-body simulation should be affected by baryonic processes, we do try to account for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
And so how many free parameters are there in this model?
The main ones are, I guess it depends on what you mean by free parameters, but the main ones are called the, so this parameter that quantifies this relation, so this power, for example, and the proportionality constant here. So those are two parameters. These are some of the most important. And the second is this depletion time here. And there is a parameter, this psi parameter, that affects the size. So I would say 4 or 5 in the basic version. But the key is that those parameters are adjusted to say, in this case, adjusted them to reproduce these two relations. Right. And we didn't adjust them to reproduce this, or this, or many other things.
Right, I see.
Yeah.
But this depletion time is assumed to be the same for all the galaxies independent of their mass?
That's an assumption. That's not necessarily a correct assumption, but that's an assumption of the fiducial model. And that can be easily relaxed, and you can see what effect it has. Mm-hmm. And I did this for high redshift galaxies, but so far, like, we can just... All of this is for single.
Yeah, for single. Yeah, that's impressive. Oh, as also, yeah. Mike Hudson also has a question.
It wasn't clear to me. Are you only? I mean, in the real universe, of course, there are elliptical galaxies, mergers, and so on. Are you just trying to reproduce dwarf galaxies only, or are you trying to do the whole spectrum of the galaxy population?
In this case, we focus on dwarf galaxies precisely because of the reasons you mentioned, so we can ignore all those other things, right? It's, of course, possible to extend this model the way it's usually done in synalytic models to include the full range, the full spectrum, at the cost of additional parameters and complexity. The minimal equation that have been used here, you can get away with them and ignoring all these other processes if you focus on the dwarf galaxy region. And that's what we're doing. So, but dwarf galaxies is a pretty wide sense here. So it's all the way up to L star. So like I said, L star galaxies here, this is Milky Way progenitor, and the model does pretty well in reproducing simulations for L star. But I would not use it for ellipticals, you're right.
All right, spirals then, okay.
Yeah, so Milky Way, L star galaxy and below, yeah.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Lee, you had a question?
Hey, quick question. There used to be a story about the baryonic Tully Fisher relation and how that was something that cold dark matter would have trouble reproducing. Do we now have a story that goes the opposite way?
Exactly, yeah. So all I can say, yes, it's been debated. And one of the ideas was that the form of the baryonic Tully Fisher, the fact that it has the slope of 4, is a unique signature of modified Newtonian dynamics models, and it is true. But what is also true, and this is illustrated in this plot, where the model galaxies are shown by blue points, whereas observed galaxies are shown by orange and red points. But as far as we can tell, the model naturally reproduces the observed relation as well without any tweaking of parameters. So this is true also for other correlations that modified Newtonian dynamics predicted, such as acceleration, luminosity. The similar relation can be produced in MDCDM, and there's debate of which model does it better, but you know, like this is the result of the model I'm presenting, right? And I would say that's matches observations pretty well.
But there's something physical to understand here.
Yeah, there is a physical, there is a way to understand it physically, which I'm not going to go with due to lack of time, but yeah, there is a way to understand why it arises in MDCDM. Yeah.
Okay.
And I should say that it here I only show baryonic Tully Fish relation. This is mass of stars and gas. But if I take a gas away, that's also a prediction. We just look at stellar masses. That relation has a bend, and it is reproduced also by this model. So it matches both if you just use stellar mass or if you use gas and stellar mass, or if you use gas only. So all those relations would be matched by this model.
I have a question. You believe that the dark matter model can explain the Tully-Fisher relation?
Yes. I mean, this is what this plot shows, yes. Okay, so the first crisis that the first challenge that I'm going to consider is the so-called planes of satellites distribution. This is a plot from a review of Marcel Pavlovsky, 2018, and it shows what the essence of the problem is. That the satellite distribution, there's the points shown around the center of the Milky Way, around Andromeda, and around centers A, and there are some other galaxies where people are measuring this, but these are three main ones. Appear to be in flattened distributions, so they are not isotropically distributed, but in a flattened configuration. And in cases, these red and blue colors are showing also the sense of rotation, where the galaxy is approaching or receding. And you can see that there is some signature that they are, it's planar distribution also rotating. For the Milky Way, where we measure the orbital parameters really well now, thanks to Gaia, parallaxes and proper motion measurements. We also know that if we look at the distribution of poles of orbits, so directions perpendicular to the orbit of each satellite, those poles are correlated. So it's not just a transient configuration here that we see that the poles of the orbits are actually aligned. And this is the dispersion of the orbital poles for the Milky Way, where each galaxy pole is shown by a point, and this circle is kind of represents the dispersion. This has been used in several papers, but in particular in this one by Pavlovsky and Krupa, to argue that such configurations are exceedingly rare in LambdaCDM. So this is a quote from the abstract in Marcel Pavlovsky, kind of Nature mini review of this. And you can see that he says that rarity of similar structures in cosmological simulation constitutes a major problem for LambdaCDM. And this is based, the statement is based on results of Pavlovsky and Krupa, which compared the thickness, so how thin the distribution of satellites is in space. This is a thickness, a measure of thickness of the distribution. This is how well, what is the dispersion of orbital poles. In Milky Way, dispersion is pretty small. And the majority of the analyzed simulations from TNG-100 and majority of simulated Milky Way sized systems lie here, whereas Milky Way lies here. And so they say this is very inconsistent. Milky Way is like a very strong outlier. And this is what the statement is based on. So we compared, we repeated this exercise in our model where we can tell which galaxies, we can take Milky Way sized halos, we can tell which galaxies are bright. And so we can select similar type of galaxies to what people do in Milky Way. And this is a result of this from a paper from Farmcraftsov and myself and Mangatkar. And there is a similar result also from a different group from Durham. And the result is that their distributional satellites are indeed rare, but not exceedingly rare. So depending on which parameters you look at, this is plane thickness versus median distance of the satellites to the center of the galaxy. This is dispersion of the pole angles versus thickness. These contours are representing what is expected in LambdaCDM simulation. The star is the Milky Way, and you can see this 2 to 3 sigma outlier. So it is an outlier. So there may be tension about properties of satellite distribution and what's expected for average, but then we don't know whether Milky Way is average. The reason that similar configurations in nearby galaxies exist, they may be due to our location in the local sheet. For example, it's been shown that orientation of these planes of satellites is also oriented along with a large-scale distribution of galaxies. So the tidal forces that sort of herd the satellites when they accrete onto galaxies may play a role in creating such configuration. And that's something actually has been observed, but not convincingly shown. Yes.
Yeah, just wondering. So, should we believe this or illustrates TNG results?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So you can ask, you know, why we're getting this conclusion versus while they got this conclusion. So you should believe this result because in this paper we demonstrated that when the resolution of the simulation is lower, you're gonna have a much smaller accuracy. So the explanation for why they got this result for TNG is because resolution of the TNG is just not sufficient enough. And this is one of the challenges, you know, of using simulations is you also have to also be aware and account for resolution effects. And they can really mess up the results. So you have to be really careful. The resolution simulation we use here is orders of magnitude higher than TNG.
Okay.
And thanks. Again, a similar conclusion was also reached in this paper using much higher resolution simulations. And explanation was similar as well.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, but I would say it's fair to say that there is a tension, and it's not like a crisis, but it's a tension. And I think it's upon a Lambda CDM to actually explain why Milky Way and other nearby galaxies are showing this aligned distribution. There is a hint that all of them are aligned with the distribution of galaxies within 10 megaparsecs, so-called local sheet, but that hint is still not been convincingly demonstrated that that's what could be reproduced in Lambda CDM simulations because it requires much larger volume. The second challenge I'm going to discuss is too big to fail problem. This is a problem that was highlighted by a series of papers by Mike Whelan-Colchin, James Bullock, and so on. It's been discussed in reviews here. And essentially, the problem consists of the fact that observation that if you look at Milky Way size halo and look at the circular velocity profiles of subhalos and such halos, compare them to observed satellites of the Milky Way shown by points, we see that there are many more objects with circular velocity that are high, whereas observed satellites do not show such high circular velocities, any of them, right? And so these big galaxies, the big halos that I expected in Lambda CDM should have formed galaxies, but somehow they're missing in the Milky Way. And therefore this is called too big to fail because these systems should have been present. They're too big to be faint, to be not observable, but we don't see them. That's the essence of the problem. Now, in the model that I presented to you, we looked at the correlation of the total mass. So this is effectively circular velocity measurement. They measure the circular velocity for these observed galaxies within the half-light radius of the satellite, the dwarf galaxy. And that's because this is the most accurate. So the masses within half-light radius can be measured using a fairly accurate relation. And it's been tested in a variety of ways, and it's quite accurate to maybe 30-50%. And we can reproduce the model, again, without any change of parameters, can reproduce this total mass within half-light radius of the functional luminosity. And the observed galaxies that we know and for which velocity dispersions and half-life radiator measures are shown by stars, with a model shown by median line and shaded regions, and we can reproduce. There is a relation, the total mass scales with galaxy luminosity, and this relation naturally is reproduced in the model, and again, it can be understood. You can look at scaling relations of CDM halos and understand why it arises like this. So we know that we can reproduce the relation between total mass within half-light radius and luminosity of the galaxy. So if there is discrepancy in the number of objects as a function of total mass, it's just abundance, right? So we know that such relation arises in Lambda CDM models using standard galaxy formation physics. So if we count satellites as a function of this total mass within half-light radius, if we see discrepancy, that would be discrepancy purely in the number of subhalos, not due to galaxy formation. And that's kind of interesting. So I looked at whether the model and observed distribution of satellites as a function of this total mass in the Milky Way over the entire probed mass of satellites, so from outer fains to classical satellites, the original problem was actually formulated just using massive satellites. But now we understand the selection function and everything related to observations well enough so we can compare the abundance of galaxies as a function of the total mass over the entire spectrum from ultra faints to massive satellites. What you can see here is a kind of the essence of the conclusion that I derived from this comparison, that if I look at some of the galaxies or some of the objects of Milky Way size mass, in this case, 1.6 10 to the 12, in this case, 9.8 10 to 11, they're all within, so, you know, somewhere close to the Milky Way. But you can see that conclusions you can draw are very different. The observed distribution of total mass as shown by magenta is very different from model one here in this object, but very similar in this object. And so there is quite a bit of variation from object to object. And I find that in particular, when we get to masses close to 9 or 10 to 11 solar masses, when 200 or mass within 100 kiloparsec about 5.5 10 to 11, you generally find that they agree. And the reason it's interesting is because this mass within 100 kiloparsec is not now measured relatively well using the motions of Milky Way, LMC, and SMC using Gaia data. We now know Milky Way mass within, say, 100 kiloparsecs to something like 10%, 10, 15%. And so what I find is that the objects which match such mass within 100 kiloparsec, they tend to not have any difference in abundance of dwarf satellites as a function of this total mass. In other words, in those objects, it too big to fail problem does not exist. If I look at more massive objects, even just by a little bit, by factor 1.5, then generally you see discrepancy, not just for the massive things, but also for the ultra faint galaxies. So the my interpretation is that too big to fail problem initially was mainly the result of using halo masses that were too high, because at that time, Milky Way was believed to have halo mass of about between 1 and 2, 10 to the 12, whereas recent measurements indicated the halo mass of the Milky Way is considerably smaller, closer to 9, 10 to the 11. Right. And then, as I mentioned, the last few minutes, do I have a few minutes still? No.
Yeah, for sure. I'm not sure that I understood the previous point. So the difference between the left and the right examples was like the concentration basically of the dark matter distribution.
Yeah, you picked up on us on a more subtle point. Yeah, so the very first thing that needs to be matched in the halo mass, the virial mass. And the second, what you are discussing, also concentration, because what I find is that the objects that match the observed distribution of total masses the best are the objects that match both the mass within 100 kiloparsec and the virial mass measurements for the Milky Way, and that also depends on concentration as well as the total mass.
So is our galaxy's inferred concentration then somewhat unusual? Like, so is that how I should interpret this?
I have not looked at this in detail, but maybe, yes. But at least, for the object that match, I mean, it's not that unusual, because out of 30 plus objects, which I looked at within masses between 5, 10 to 11, and 10 to 12, a few match Milky Way. So it's not very particularly unusual.
Oh, okay.
It's not average, but it's...
Thanks.
But of all the objects that are closely matching the halo mass and this mass in the 100 kiloparsec, almost all of them are very close to observed ones. But I wouldn't say it's particularly unusual.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to come back to this plot where I pointed out that the scatter and star formation rates of dwarf galaxies is larger than the model predicts, because it's important for interpretation of the abundance of high-redshift galaxies. So the reason, like I said, is because in the fiducial model, we just don't model the processes that lead to this burstiness, which is modeling of individual star-forming regions. Simulations, high-resolution simulations do that, and we can use those for guidance for how much stochasticity can be added to the model to reproduce this burstiness and the scatter star formation rate. And this can be done using a framework that was developed in the last few years by Sandro Tekela and collaborators, where they essentially looked at the stochasticity of star formation rate in galaxies in different masses, showed that it can be modeled fairly reasonably by a standard way by drawing correlated random numbers with a given power spectrum and perturbing star formation rate that is non-stochastic, that is just to reflect the average evolution of the galaxy with to produce a stochasticity, produce scattering deformation rate. And this illustration, this is what fiducial model produces shown by the dashed line. This is after the star formation gets perturbed by log normal scatter. So the this number is Gaussian, but then we multiply star formation by 10 to the 10. And these deltas are Gaussian numbers drawn from distribution with a given power spectrum. Why this power spectrum is chosen? It's very generic. It arises from damped random processes, random walk. But it's been shown also to describe what happens in numerical simulation. What you can see here is this power spectrum density in the fiducial model without stochasticity. This just reflects the shape of the star formation history as a function of time. And this solid line is when we add stochasticity to the level that you see here with parameters of this power spectrum chosen to have particular values. And the color line shows simulated power spectrum. And you can see that with this added stochasticity, we started matching simulations like FIRE 2, which highest resolution, they resolve in star forming regions, and they resolve these processes that drive stochasticity of the galaxies. Now, at high redshifts, the stochasticity is expected to be larger still, because galaxies are in this very fast accretion regime. They experience very highly varied accretion rates. They're small. Those previous plots showed the galaxies, most of the galaxies here were above billion solar masses. These are dwarf galaxies that are much smaller, that have halo masses below 10 to 12. And this is exactly the regime where our model is applicable. Like I said, the stellar masses here in the dwarf galaxy regime, essentially. And you can see that the power spectra here are considerably high amplitude and compared to the fiducial model. So we need to add quite a bit of stochasticity with these random numbers by bumping the normalization of the power spectra to actually match them, right? So these values that you see here, you can see that this value is on the lower side, and then this value is on the high side. And it's not easy to see, but there's actually progression in stellar mass. So these galaxies have low stellar masses. These galaxies have the largest stellar masses. And we expect the stochasticity to increase with increasing redshift, because as we go back in time, galaxies become smaller and smaller because they're growing with time. So as we go back in time, we're dealing with smaller and smaller galaxies. So we expect generally that stochasticity should increase as we push backward in time. So this is the basics. So we add the stochasticity to star formation rate, and this is a result for the UV luminosity function. It's something that should be published soon. This is with the level of stochasticity on the low side. And you can see here comparison to measurements at redshift 5, 6, 7 to 9. For measurements are shown by points, and the model predictions are shown by lines. The dashed line without stochasticity, the solid line is with stochasticity. The model matches again without any changes except for addition of the stochasticity, but the amount of stochasticity that you need to explain the luminosity function is really small. In fact, I can change these parameters. For example, I can change depletion time, make it somewhat smaller, and I can match this luminosity function with zero stochasticity. So stochasticity at this redshift is not particularly important. And it probably is there at this level, but again, it's not critical. At higher redshifts, however, we see a signature that probably is critical. So this is prediction for what happens beyond redshift 10 with the same parameters, exactly the same parameters as at redshift 0. And you can see that the model prediction compared to the data now shown by points is below, and the discrepancy increases with increasing redshift. So at redshift 10, it's relatively small, but it's still there. And as you go to redshift 12 and 13, the discrepancy between the model and observations grows. This is the reason for those headlines that people have this is the discrepancy, the abundance of UV luminous galaxies. Even though the stellar masses are small, they're UV bright, and their abundance seem to be higher than this fiducial model indicates. But again, this is the model where stochasticity of star formation is small, right? It's at the same level, and I just showed you that it's expected to increase towards higher redshifts. So if we crank it up to the level that simulations show, these solid lines now show the model with the stochasticity, and you can see that it matches this luminosity function. So if the star formation rate is stochastic, in other words, there is quite a bit of fluctuation of star formation at a given stellar mass, it's not a problem at all to match the UV luminosity function using the standard galaxy formation physics with the parameters that are very similar to what we see in high resolution simulation that existed before any of these measurements have been done. The reason—
Can I ask you a question? I mean, there should be a limit on how much you can push the stochasticity, because I mean, there's like so much variance you have in the system. So if you cannot just increase the amplitude of a star formation with some arbitrary random number. So
that's right. Yes, you're right. Yeah, so it's very perceptive observation. I checked this, and we're very safe because these galaxies are extremely gas-rich, so there's much more gas in them than available than any fluctuation that you see that's required to do this. And I have a plot for this, but I'll refrain. I can show you later. So I did check for this. The efficiency, the fraction of stars that the fraction of baryons that are converted into stars to reproduce this UV luminosity function is very small compared to what's available. The reason this happens is very simple, because the without stochasticity, UV luminosity function is very steep. So when we add scatter, there's many more objects from faint luminosities get upscattered to high luminosities. And this flattens luminosity function. You can see that the as you go to higher redshift, the underlying luminosity stellar mass function gets steeper, and the apparent UV luminosity function gets flatter. So this actually is a prediction of this model for measurements that are not yet done at higher redshifts. The prediction is that there should be a measuring luminosity function that is considerably flatter than at low redshifts. Right. Right now there are measurements, but they're very tentative, but this is something that probably will be firmed up with future JWST observations. So this is, sorry, I ran a little bit over time, but this is pretty much all I wanted to tell you is that the perceived challenges of Lambda CDM, if examined rigorously within a reasonable galaxy formation framework that explains the properties or like the bulk of properties of dwarf galaxies, they close examination of every challenge indicate that they actually can be accommodated to explain this Lambda CDM, with the possible exception of the planes of satellite problem, where we do not have a convincing explanation. The only thing that we can see is that the frequency of such planes is not excluding Lambda CDM, but the configuration that we observe are relatively rare. And so thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Okay, great. So let's give Andre a round of applause for his great talk. Okay. So
I can stick around for as long as needed if somebody wants to chat.
Sure, great. So why don't we take a few questions? So Mike, you have your hand raised.
So you know, the UV luminosity function is of course very sensitive to the most newly formed short-lived stars. So are there prospects for, you know, making the same kind of measurement either at longer wavelengths or even better using like this total stellar mass, which, you know, might be less sensitive to short time scale fluctuations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so very, very good question. So one of the implications of this interpretation the reason we see such high apparent abundance of UV bright galaxies is due to burstiness of star formation. The implication is that the ages of stars should be short. And I should say that something I don't show here, but I have a plot showing the ages of functional stellar mass, and the model produces ages that are consistent with measurements. But in measurements, it's difficult precisely because if star formation is bursty, then the standard methods of estimating stellar masses, for example, from photometry, are suspect. And there are papers written on this that you actually have to be very careful. You have to use a model that also has stochasticity when you derive the stellar masses. And this is probably one of the reasons why people derive stellar masses that are very high for some galaxies. That's my suspicion, but that has to be examined more carefully. There is one paper written on this recently. But this definitely probably is an issue. In general, what observations measure is that the average age of stars in these galaxies above redshift 10 is about 30 to 50 million years. So they're very young. In the model, when I measure, I have star formation history. When I measure the ages of stars, they're also very young. And this actually has nothing to do with stochasticity. It's just because the universe is very young. So the galaxies are forming very, very fast. And whenever we see a bright galaxy, it formed most of its stars not so long ago. So the galaxies are all undergoing sort of overall burst because they're evolving extremely fast. And on top of this overall burst, there is also burstiness because of, you know, individual star formation and blowout events.
Thanks.
Can I ask a question? I don't mean to be a philosophical question, but a physics question. If experiment in the future continues not to see a dark matter particle consistent with galaxy and cosmology data, how does this influence our understanding of dark matter models?
Yeah, so I think it's a great question, and the most difficult part is if we end up essentially basing the galaxy formation framework, the entire framework, based on something that cannot be confirmed experimentally. I should say that we're already basing the cosmological model based on lambda vacuum energy, right? That we have no physical explanation for, and I don't know of any experimental prospects of actually probing what it is, right? So the part of cosmological model that doesn't directly enter galaxies but does influence the rate of growth of galaxies at late times because it affects the expansion rate of the universe, that part of the model is already there. Dark matter that is much more directly governing evolution of galaxies is assumed, but like you said, is not detected. What we can see from studying galaxy formation with different assumptions about dark matter is that for galaxy formation, you can construct a a model with dark matter properties that are indistinguishable from cold dark matter. It doesn't mean that cold dark matter is the real dark matter, but whatever dark matter is, it has to be essentially very close to what cold dark matter is. And that's the defense for the model is that it reproduces a wide range of observations, starting from cosmic microwave background down now to the smallest galaxies at the full redshift range, right? So there is something to be said, if we talk about philosophy, there's something to be said when model reproduces a huge variety of observations, right? It's not a final proof, but it's something that where you cannot discount it easily. At the same time, of course, it's very unsatisfying. It would be much more satisfying and convincing if dark matter particle was detected. And the efforts, of course, are continuing, but you're right that it's not guaranteed that we actually ever detect dark matter particle.
Yeah, because
So in the interest of time, why don't we stop the official recording here? So people should be, most people should feel free to leave. But Andre said that he can stick around for longer if there's further questions. Okay, so thanks everyone for coming.